Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 103, The People's Judaism. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And this is kind of our 100th episode. I mean, it's actually our 103rd episode, but in the mythic, metaphysical sense, we kind of want to give it a round number and say this is, you know, our kind of look back on the first 100 episodes, or we could say the first 2 years, although technically I think it's a few more weeks until it's actually 2 years, but next week is our 104th episode, and you could sort of say that's the, well, I don't know, you can't really say
that. Well, if Shabbat can be 25 hours instead of 24 hours, and if in the Talmud 40 lashes can mean 39 lashes, and I feel like we're fine in the world of Judaism to say that 103 is now a round number. We run with it.
All right, I like the way you think. Before we get started, like we always do in these discussion episodes, we just want to give a few messages to our listeners. First of all, thanks so much to those of you who responded to the survey that we circulated a few weeks ago. It was really helpful to get a lot of information on how you're using Judaism Unbound, what it means to you. So thank you for all of that. So many people responded so positively to that survey, and so enthusiastically to that survey, that I feel like we might as well also suggest that you might be interested in responding just as enthusiastically to our pleas for financial support, which we need just as much as
I see
the,
what you did there.
which we need just as much as that survey information. We haven't actually pointed out that since the launch of the new Apple Podcasts app, which there are many ways I don't love that much, but one cool thing about it is that you can actually just look down right now if you're using the Apple Podcast app, which our data suggests that about half of you are, and look and see the episode description. And right there, there are various links that you can click on, including the link to our donate page at www.judaismunbound.com/donate. So you could do that right now. You could go and click on that. And within the podcast app, while you're listening to me talk, you could be making a donation right now. And
you could even choose which finger you use. You can use your thumb. You can use your pointer finger, your pinky if you want to. Like, any of them works.
We really appreciate any donation. We've talked before that we love the idea of a donation of $1 per episode that you listen to. So if you listen to Judaism Unbound every week, we hope you might consider a donation of something like $50. If you listen to Judaism Unbound only occasionally, you can maybe consider a donation of $18. We also want to say that for many folks that don't always realize, we have a JudaismUnbound.com website that has all of our podcasts on it, but it also has all kinds of other resources that we're excited about, including a growing number of podcast transcripts. But it also has all kinds of ideas and resources about the holidays, and we're looking to build that website up over the next year. And so we hope that you'll visit it and bookmark it and give us suggestions about what you think should be on there, what would be useful to you as you try to take the ideas that we're playing with and apply them in your life. So please check it out and give us feedback. And the last thing I just want to note, because I don't think we've really mentioned it in a while, is that we have verified that the Amazon Alexa does work with Judaism Unbound. You just have to pronounce it as Judaism Unbound. She does not understand Judaism Unbound. So if you tell Alexa, and I'll do it right now so that if somebody's house has it, maybe we'll be able to activate it right from this podcast. If you say, Alexa, play the latest episode of Judaism Unbound, she should do it. Anyway, let's move on to our episode. And let's start big picture. And it really flows very much from our recent conversations with Yitz Greenberg and Barbara Tita. And they both really spoke to me. And I think they're consistent with one another. And I think, I guess I'd also bring in that when we started the podcast 2 years ago, our first interview was with B'nai Lapi, who also has a view of Jewish history or Jewish mythology, whatever we want to call it, a sense of sort of where we are in the Jewish story. I guess that's the way that I want to put it. And for me, Yitz Greenberg's idea of the third era of Judaism, although I might quibble and say that I, pardon me, thinks we're in the fourth or maybe even the fifth era of Judaism, that speaks a lot to me, the idea that we are at the dawn of a new Judaism. And that, you know, I think in some response to some of our episodes or to some things that we've posted on Facebook, some people have raised this question, well, what difference does it make that we're pointing out that history wasn't as we learned it, or that Judaism may be based on a myth? Isn't everything based on a myth? And on the one hand, yes, that's true. And we all kind of know that many societies, many organizations, many countries are based on myths, that their histories aren't always exactly the way we learned it in school. So what difference does that make? And to me, it just makes the difference that it makes is that it gives us some feeling of authenticity that we might not have if we thought that history was all leading in a certain direction and that we are going in a different direction, that somehow that seems like a larger disruption or a larger departure than might seem authentic. If you have a sense that history was quite different from the way we learned it, or maybe we don't really know exactly what the history was, or that we know that there were various myths that were created hundreds of years after the events that they describe, then at least for me, it feels a little bit freer to experiment with other potential directions and to see where that takes us, and feeling less a sense that we're somehow violating the past.
I think that brings me back to the conversation we had with Yehuda Kurtzer about history and memory, where he brought up some points that I think we could use, and that I think some of those Facebook posts critiquing us could use. I think, but yeah, there is this question of mythology. Does our past need to be true? Does it? And we talk about this with Richard Elliott Friedman too, about does the Exodus need to be true for us to gain value from it? His stance was that it did. My stance is that whether or not it is true is actually not my core question. I do have thoughts about the answer to that question, but my question is mostly, how do I use it as a tool that I can then apply to my Jewish life, to my existence as a human being, etc.? And that links more broadly, I think, to an ongoing conversation thread that you and I have been having that I think we haven't resolved, but that I think our disagreement, or at least our discussion, has been a great part of this podcast thus far, which is Judaism fundamentally what I would term a library that provides you access to a set of ideas? Or is Judaism, or should Judaism really stand for a specific set of, whether it's values or ideas, etc., which I don't want to speak for you, but I think you have maybe not said that we're there yet, but said that it would be great if we could be there at one point in the future.
Yeah, so I want to start with a little bit of thinking through Yitz Greenberg's three eras and moving, or sort of taking that idea a little bit further. First of all, I want to put the theology to the side for the moment, because I actually find it very powerful, whether as actual theology or, I think for me, more as a metaphor. I find the idea that he's putting out there of God sort of moving further and further out from the world, which leaves more responsibility on human shoulders. For me, that's extremely powerful as a metaphor, but I think it's not necessarily critical for our conversation to have agreement on whether we're talking about an actual being or a metaphor or whatever. I'm kind of focusing more on the historical dimensions, the eras that Judaism has gone through, and the idea that we have a past in which Judaism changed profoundly from the first era to the second era, essentially from the biblical era to the rabbinic era, makes it feel more authentic and more fine if we think that the situation has changed sufficiently to say, and now we're moving from the rabbinic era to a new era. Now, it's interesting because I think really, as I've been thinking through Yitz Greenberg's concept, it's actually sort of hit me that I'm a little bit less interested in the eras than in the transitions between the eras. And so there's a way in which I'm not sure that we're in the third era. I am pretty sure, though, that we're wandering in the wilderness between the second era and the third era. The question is, what emerges on the other side of that? And I think this is where we were when we started the podcast. The answer is, we don't know, right? And I feel less bound, less needed, less. I feel like it's less necessary to say, hey, we really know what the next era of Judaism is going to look like. But I think that we can say, or I believe that we can say, that whatever it will look like, it will have emerged out of the activities of regular people, people who don't have a genetic lineage like priests that gives them that authority, people who don't have a certified lineage of like rabbis that gives them that authority, but rather people who are really just regular people that have the capacity to create something new, and the success will be determined by whether people follow them, not by any sort of claim of authority.
I want to bring up, though, what I think is another theme that we've revisited over the course of time, once again, because you and I differ on it, which is the question of whether what we are striving for is the next sort of coherent era, to use Greenberg's idea, whether it's third or fourth or fifth or seventh, like whether that's the goal, is to create sort of a coherent set of ideas and teachings and practices or folkways or whatever that we call Judaism, and that is a new form, versus whether we just sort of concede that the whole premise of a coherent Judaism bounded by certain eras, this is now me talking, like whether we've created those eras as helpful ways of understanding history, but throughout it's really been a whole lot murkier than that, and whether there has been one or two or three eras, for me, is not even my main question anymore. It's should we just say, you know, history is always changing and Judaism is always changing, and what we call it, we didn't call it Judaism, then we did call it Judaism. We used certain languages, then we didn't use those languages, then we used new languages. We celebrated certain holidays, then we celebrated different holidays, then we added new holidays. That, like, for me, I'm reaching more and more of a place where in the scope of our operating system versus app conversation, whether that's the Judaism that we want in the future, and I do think that's sort of what we're talking about here, I'm less interested, for me, in the operating system, which does, I think, imply sort of a coherent set of stuff that is collectively Judaism, versus the app, which I feel like is something that people use and then apply in whichever way they apply in their operating systems that exist. So that there's a lot of stuff to basically say. I agree so deeply with what you're saying in terms of we need a people's Judaism. What's less clear to me is whether the people's Judaism really is sort of like the Judaism of the future, or whether it's the strategy, it's the set of ways of accessing Judaism that is going to create awesome forms of Jewish practice in the future, whether they call themselves part of one Judaism or not.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I think you're right on to point that out and to highlight that as an open question. That's why I think I'm focusing in on this idea of the fourth or fifth wandering as opposed to the third or fourth or fifth era, right? You know, because in the wandering, it's a period of uncertainty and a period of exploration. So I don't necessarily think that it's critically important for us to know or even assert what's going to happen on the other end. Is it going to be the recoherence of a new Judaism? And then you can even ask the question of, like, that suggests that there ever was a coherence of Judaism before, and get into all that. And we can have that conversation. I think it's really interesting. But it's not necessarily necessary to say that what's going to come out on the other end is a new coherence, or what's going to come out on the other end is a modular, like you've said before, a library that, you know, maybe they're going to be some sections in that library. Like, right, people are more likely to hang out in the sci-fi section or in the nonfiction section, and there's going to be a few dominant sections of that library, and those are going to be the kind of the main movements or whatever we call them, or not, or it's just going to be kind of a free-for-all. And one of the, obviously, like, one of the innovations that that drives some of that thinking is that we currently are sort of at the dawn of the digital age, right? But it's only going to become more and more digital. And so there's only going to be, so if you look right now and you say, hey, look how powerful search is on Google, and we can find any information that we want in seconds, and we can put our own set of ideas together all the time. Well, I don't know exactly how, but my assumption is that that's going to become even more easy in the future, you know, and so whatever we're seeing now is going to be only more so in 10 years and certainly in 100 years. So in a way that it would have been kind of impossible in a past time, right, I can easily imagine a Judaism as library, right, a Judaism where there is really like no movement, right, no clear sense that there's a right way to be Jewish, there's a set of things that always belongs together, but rather that Judaism is a wide variety of possibilities, a wide variety of offerings, and people can navigate them on their own. Now, I mean, there's some ways in which I think that that would be a good thing, and there's some ways in which I think that would be a bad thing, just because, right, like, I would be very sad if, for some reason, a lot of people navigated towards some of the uglier books in that library. You know, and there's some way in which I'm trying to articulate that, yeah, I can see how technically that would be Judaism, but it certainly wouldn't be a Judaism that I would want to have much to do with. So the question becomes, you know, in a world in which Judaism is kind of much more modular and much more of a library, how does somebody say, but I don't see myself as a fellow traveler with those folks who are accessing books from the section that I think is kind of the uglier section?
When I've brought up library for Judaism in the past, I've basically meant it's full of different books, and different people go into the library and they check out different books, so that for every person who uses the library is, in effect, a different thing because they access different parts of it. I stand by that, and I think that's important, and that's maybe the most important characteristic of what I see Judaism as a library as being. But I also have been thinking, okay, what's a library really like today? When you say you're going to the library and you're in college, it doesn't necessarily mean you're checking out a book. And honestly, the percentage of times where I was going to the library in college and I was checking out a book was very low. Some of the times I was going, I was using a computer and researching that way. Some of the times I was going just to hang out with friends. Some of the times I was going to do a group project. And none of those uses of a library would have been imaginable from the fact that there weren't computers, and also the fact that people didn't use libraries as like public gathering spaces, as far as I know, in other areas. Like, none of those would have been imaginable uses of a library 100 years ago, or certainly more than that. But they're now very definitely understood as meanings of a library, and to the point where if you say, I'm going to the library in college, people probably assume you are not checking out a book more than they assume that you are checking out a book. And so I think about Judaism, and I think that's a perfect reflection of how, if you had said, I'm going to do Judaism, although you wouldn't have said that, but if you had theoretically said that a few thousand years ago, you would have meant a set of things that are totally fundamentally different from what they are now. And we can bring up sacrifice as the obvious example, but there's lots and lots of others. So I like that. I also like that people have library cards. So there still is an understanding that, like, you're sort of a member of this library, but it's not so easy because people who don't have library cards also use the library and usually are able to get guest passes. And it's not like there's some big, terrible process to use the library if you are not a member. There are often public libraries, which are there specifically for the public to access them. So I think that's a perfect metaphor of how more and more people who don't have their Judaism cards or like membership in Judaism are accessing elements of Judaism for their own lives.
You know, I'm sympathetic to that, you know, and at the same time, there's a part of me that I think within the subset of people who are using this library, right, I'm really, I think I personally am aspiring to one day start a book club, you know, something where that says, right, that says like, okay, but we're going to have like a subgroup that's going to say we're really about something much narrower than this, you know. And we have a relationship to this larger library, but we ultimately are looking for something much narrower than that. And that, you know, and in my mind, some of the narrowing dimensions are that, right? Like, I think that I am ultimately looking for some kind of coherence. I think that I am ultimately looking for to make sure that the community that I see as my fellow travelers is a community that's primarily oriented towards, you know, repairing the world, towards making the world a better place, you know. And while I recognize that you can use this material for things that don't make the world a better place, it's not exactly that I don't want to call those folks Jews, but I don't want to call them whatever I call myself. I'm not fully committed to living in community or feeling like part of the same family, right, with folks that are using the material from this library in a way that doesn't accord with who I want to be. And by the way, I want to say really clearly, I very much respect those who don't want to live in community with me because they see me as not using the tools from the library in a way that they respect.
Yeah, I agree with that. And if I were sitting in line at the checkout counter at the library and the person in front of me was checking out The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, you know, two famous books that are at the core of a lot of contemporary philosophy that I strongly, strongly disagree with, I wouldn't feel an affinity with that person. And I think that, I mean, I would argue, and once you can disagree, like, I think that's another reason why the library makes more sense than some structures where membership in it is more of a shared idea. I don't feel when I'm in a library that everybody with the library card and I share something particularly deep. Clearly, we have a similar thing in each of our wallets that allows us access to the place. And on some level, I do think if I knew nothing else about a person except for that they are members of the same library as I am, like, that would be something. Would it be more than me sharing a birthday with them? Probably not. Would it be more than me rooting for the same sports team as them? Definitely not. And so, like, that for me is why I think that this model might work. But I totally concede to you that it doesn't leave a lot of room for expressing anything that is very directly not part of it. And so that's just a weakness in my model that I have accepted for my purposes, but you're right to identify it.
Well, I think that raises the, you know, some of the questions that we talked early on with folks like Shaul Magid, and but also with various other people, which are like, you know, and we will talk about them again, I know, in the months ahead, is that, you know, some of the ways that Judaism has been described, maybe all of the ways that Judaism has been described in the last few hundred years that people have been kind of comfortable with, right? Judaism is a religion. Judaism is a peoplehood. Judaism is primarily about community. Judaism is a family, whatever it is. And Yehuda Kirchner talks about these things too, as, you know, problem, you can problematize all of those things. And to my mind, what I think is part of what's going to go on is that whatever Judaism becomes, whatever direction Judaism goes in, is going to be much more charted by the decisions that regular Jews make than it has been in the past time. And I think that there was an early flowering of this in the 1960s and 1970s. I mean, not only in Judaism, but also in Judaism in the form of the Havarah movement that we talked about with Revel and Prel, and in the form of the Jewish catalog and a variety of kind of DIY approaches to being Jewish. There was sort of an initial flowering of that. And I think that what we're going to see is much more of that. And what I'd like to see is much more of that. And the only reason, though, that I think that some of that doesn't happen or won't happen is because regular Jews don't think that they're allowed to do that. You know, somehow they don't feel authentic in doing it. It's not like they feel like somebody's going to stop them. It's just in their mind, it's not their role. The other piece that I think is that I've been kind of mulling around in my head is the role for artists. An artist, in principle, is someone who could do something very big, right? An artist could reimagine a community, could create a whole synagogue, could create a whole TV show, or various big things. But an artist puts the art out for the people and is very comfortable with the idea that people will choose to embrace it or not. You know, and there's no artist, I think, who goes out and says, people must appreciate my art. You know, artists put their art out there and they say, I make this as an offering. Whereas people who feel that they have been placed in a position of authority often imagine either because of the certification of their authority, right? I graduated from this school and therefore I'm an expert and you should listen to me. Or because they imagine that the people kind of elected them or hired them or placed them in this position and that somehow that gives them the right to sort of say how things are going to go, and that if people follow them, if people do what they're asking them to do, that's great. And that if people don't do what they're asking them to do, the people have somehow failed. And the other way that I'm very intrigued by is the idea that there could be the emergence of a class of what I'm calling Jewish artists. It's not just people that are painting and creating plays, but I'm also just thinking of someone like Amichai Lau-Lavi, who happens to be a rabbi, as an artist, right? Because he's sort of creating a new kind of spiritual center. And he sort of places that as an offering for people. And a lot of people are wanting to accept that offering, you know, but there's no way in which he's saying, you know, I'm here to tell you the right way to be Jewish.
What we need is creativity. We need the creative impulse. And we've said that in a variety of ways over the course of our podcast, but that's what it boils down to. And I want to try to like map all of what we're saying into sort of an easily digestible line of ideas. So idea one, our premise, we are in a time of wandering. Given that Judaism in a while, whether it's a decade or a century or 500 years, because of that wandering, is going to look very different from what it does now. Just point blank, it will. For us, we see that actually as good. Whether you see it as good or bad is largely immaterial to this map. But given that we don't know what Judaism is going to be, we want whatever it's going to be good. So we need to be doing all sorts of stuff, experimenting, playing with new practices, creating literal and metaphorical art, using our artistic impulse in other ways. And when we do that, we believe that we will stumble into some practices and ideas and traditions and holidays and new historical, they'll be historical in 500 years, new things that will become part of Judaism, or whether we call it Judaism writ large, they'll at least be Jewish things. That's the project for me. And I think you're totally right to say that we don't really have any obstacles in the way of that project practically. We only have mental blocks. And I say we because I have absolutely experienced this too. The creative impulse tells us that, okay, we're going to take something that does not yet exist and make it exist. It's not a retention-based or, to use a Hebrew word, shamor-based, to keep or guard or, you know, protect. That's what we've been taught to do in Jewish life. We got to have that creative impulse. That's the thesis statement.
Yeah, and you know, it's really, I mean, I've said this a few times when thinking about the ultra-Orthodox, which is, you know, that where Shalom Dean talked to us about how it wasn't the non-believers who would leave the ultra-Orthodox community, but the more creative people, because ultra-Orthodoxy doesn't reward creativity, doesn't really want creativity. And what struck me as I continually think about that is that that's not so untrue of all the other parts of Judaism, right? It's not just ultra-Orthodoxy that doesn't appreciate creativity. It's most of Judaism that doesn't appreciate creativity or that wants to cabin creativity. Look, you want to write some new tunes? That's fine. You know, you want to paint some pretty pictures? That's fine. But if your creativity is the reimagination of Judaism, that no, thank you. I was thinking, like, could it be helpful to sort of lay out some of the various mental blocks, like as you put it, that are in the way. You know, I think we've talked a lot about this feeling of a lack of authenticity. You know, it's not my place as a non-rabbi, as a regular Jew, right? It's not my place to take a significant leadership role in reimagining Judaism, that we want that mental block to go away. Some of the other mental blocks, though, at least like one, another one that's on my mind is this idea that Judaism is a system. What I think going forward that we're seeing on the ground, and that I really, really believe is the way that this is going to happen, is the idea that, and this is where I really embrace your metaphor of the library, right? To say Judaism is not a system, it's a library, and every single book in that library could get a new cover, or we could add new books to that library, or however you want to put it. But that, and this is where, you know, I think that the digital revolution, I think this is probably always true, but that the digital revolution really makes this all the more true and all the more powerful, in the same way that the invention of the printing press and the, you know, which both led people to be able to own books in a way that they couldn't before and promoted literacy in a way there wasn't before. So all of a sudden, every person can have a Bible. And that's kind of what drives the Protestant Reformation, that it shouldn't surprise us that a technological revolution that's just as pervasive and huge as the invention of printing would drive other reformations. So that, and again, I think that we're seeing that. I think that we're seeing that among the Jews who are aware of many of the new stuff that's going on. So I think of, like, you know, an average Jew in Boston who has both access to the internet and access to various things happening locally, right? Doesn't have to get everything from their local synagogue. They can get a mikveh from Maim Chaim, and they can get Jewish texts from Sefaria.org.
The second you have relatively sophisticated digital resources available, it's obvious how that affects access to knowledge. That's, you know, straightforward. You can Google things and learn about stuff quickly, and then you can take that knowledge and channel it into creative events or practices or whatever. Cool. What I still think we haven't fully reckoned with, and that the process of the next few generations of human beings, forget just Jews, is going to be, is how digital life has not just revolutionized access to knowledge, but access to people and creations of community. And what you said about somebody in Boston having Mayim Chaim close by, but they can get Sefaria, like, sure, they could also not join a synagogue, and in the past that would have meant basically not having, in a concrete sense, a Jewish community. Maybe they have Jewish friends, but they can join any of hundreds and hundreds of Facebook groups. I mean, it's already being called Jewbook. Within Jewbook, people talk about Left Jewbook or Jewish Left Book, because that's for the leftists that are organizing, like me. Within because it's big enough already in 2018 to have tiny subsections, that all of which still have hundreds and hundreds of people in them. And I'll tell you, the daily rhythm of my life, I participate in tons of these groups on a regular basis. I comment things and I get likes or whatever. And even if I don't get likes, I mean, people notice when I'm there and when I'm not there in a way that honestly some in-person places don't. And there are also digital Jewish communities I've been a part of that aren't particularly supportive and that don't notice anything about that. It's not that it's just better. It's that there's some good, some bad. But already, I feel, if you ask me, like, am I an engaged Jew? Am I participating in Jewish life? Am I participating in forms of Jewish community right today? I would say yes, unabashedly. Would I say that I'm involved in Providence's Jewish community? I am. I'm more involved than most people are, especially people my age. But I'm not in one of the buildings that is theoretically a Jewish space in Providence all that often. It's not how my Jewish life plays out. And I think that more and more and more, as we can communicate deeply with one another, and I do want to challenge those that think that all forms of digital communication are inherently shallow, or that you escalate conversations and arguments happen in ways they wouldn't happen in person. I'll tell you, I have a lot more effective arguments and ineffective arguments on Facebook than I have in person, because in person people are too afraid to have arguments. All of those elements of our lives and our Jewish lives are going to change as part of this third or sixth or nth era. And I want us to use that towards all the creative forms of Judaism, Jewishness, Jewish life, whatever you call it, that we're talking about.
Yeah, and to your point about the shallowness, it brings to mind another concept or a set of concepts that we've talked a lot about over the last couple of years, which is the work of Clayton Christensen, a disruptive innovation, or as I've heard recently, and I like to think of it, nonlinear innovation. And one of the mental mistakes that's made when we look at sort of some new innovation is that we praise it or critique it based on what it looks like today, where that's really not the right way to think about it, right? The way to think about it is what it's going to look like in some future period of time. So when you say, hey, I already get a lot of value out of living a largely digital Jewish life, I say, that's great. I'm thrilled to hear that that's already available. But I also would say that, gee, I mean, if you're getting what you're getting now, today in 2018, wow, what's it going to look like in 2028 or 2038? You might still say, yeah, but I can imagine even the most amazing digital experience still not right and not the same. Okay, fine, I respect that. We can have an argument. But if your critique is based on what it looks like today, then, you know, that is a mental block that I would like to see taken care of. You know, I'd like to see the conversation at the very least being one that says, yeah, we understand that things grow and evolve. And so when we're looking at some new practice or new organization or new approach, that we're not judging it based on what it looks like at the very beginning, but we're judging it based on where we see the trend lines going. And if we want to have that conversation, great. I'd love to have that conversation with anybody.
Yeah. Here is the long list of things I know about 10 years from now, 2028. Ready? The Los Angeles Summer Olympics will occur. It was just announced a few weeks ago. That's, as far as I know, there's very few things out there that plan anything 10 years in advance. The Olympics is one of them. They just announced that Los Angeles is going to host the Olympics. I'm a big Olympics guy. I'm psyched that there's going to be one in the United States. I've already, like, I want to go. Like, God willing, I'll be alive. Like, God willing, the world will still exist. But, like, I'm more certain that if the world exists, the Summer Olympics will be in Los Angeles than I am that the world will actually exist. So, you know, this, baby steps. But, like, I bring that up because it calls me back to one of our very, very earliest episodes. You're calling back to Christensen. I'm thinking of B'nai Lapi, who she says all the time and beautifully that Judaism in 100 years is going to be unrecognizable to her and to you and to me. And she also adds the corollary, and that excites me. That's 103 episodes of Judaism Unbound. That's it. Judaism in 100 years is going to look radically different from what it looks like right now, and that excites us. That's Judaism Unbound. The rest is commentary. Now go and do it. Yeah. We do need to have the commentary, and we do need to go and do it. But that's it. Like, we're at a place where we really just have to do the work, and we has to be expansive and include all of us with whatever titles or non-titles that are out there. And sort of shifting gears, but not really, because this is such an overarching theme of our podcast that it doesn't feel like we're ever shifting from it. It's always there. But just the question of large central Jewish institutions versus smaller new startups versus not even startups, but just people doing whatever they're doing and calling it Jewish. I think that's also a really important player here. And I'm flashing back to, I mean, there's very little I'm not flashing back to on that front, but I'm flashing back especially to our conversations with Rivel and Prel about the Chavura movement and also our debrief from that and thinking about how we could sort of replicate some of the models of the Chavura movement and the Jewish catalog idea, which was just sort of creating easily accessible ways for Jews themselves to do Jewish stuff. But I really think that question of who's doing this work couldn't effectively be answered without saying directly that it's not just federations, JCCs, synagogues, et cetera, the institutions that we presume to be the quote unquote Jewish community. We have to be able to say that they are part of the equation, to use a sentence that was applied differently in Barbara Tita's essay recently. The Federation, the JCCs, et cetera, are a seat at the table or a few seats at the table, but they're not the table. And we seem to think sometimes, implicitly or explicitly, that the work of Judaism, the leadership of the Jewish present and future, is going to be done by rabbis and by CEOs of Jewish nonprofits. But what we've talked about over and over again is that those institutions and people that are trained to be leaders of those institutions are not always able to respond as quickly to the needs of our time or of future times. That's really what we're talking about, as our newer institutions, as our non-institutions. So the answer to this partially is, of course, and we've had guests to talk about this, to create stronger and different in certain ways centralized Jewish institutions. But it's also to say, maybe we need to tzimtzum a little bit. Maybe we need to shrink a little bit in terms of what those institutions are presumed to be doing. And in doing that shrinking, actually elevate the role that everybody who's outside of those institutions, whether through newer, smaller ones or non-institutions, has in this whole puzzle.
Well, so I'm reflecting on this. I'm thinking, like, if I were a funder, if you accepted the idea that we are in the transition from the second era to the third era, how would that affect your funding if previously your funding had been funding in a second era world, right? So you would either say, and I'm not proposing this, you would either say, I'm going to cut off all of my second era funding because that's a waste, and I'm going to invest all of my money in the third era funding, you know, and what would that look like? Another possibility, though, is to say, okay, well, I'm going to create a diversified portfolio. And right, because the second era organizations are still important, there's still going to be a lot of Jews now and for a while who want a second era Judaism, for whom that feels really meaningful, for whom that is really meaningful. And there's nothing bad about it. All we're saying about the second era Judaism is that it's not going to be the dominant Judaism of the third era. There's nothing bad about it, and it's very worthy of support. So what I would suggest and advise to any person who's like thinking about how to allocate their resources, even their own volunteer time, is to say, no, let's continue to invest in this second era Judaism, but let's also invest in third era Judaism. And then it becomes a question of what does that look like? And in my mind, it's there's two main possibilities, right? One is that there are going to be second era organizations, like a synagogue, let's say, that might say, we want to make it into the third era. So we want to kind of run two lines of business at the same time, right? We're going to run our synagogue the way we've been running it with some tweaks, you know, like things should always be improving and changing. And that's going to be product line number one. And we're also going to start to experiment with and work on product line number two, which is a synagogue for the third era. And my question, I guess, like when we think about it in terms of, you know, where can we help? Where can others help? Where can funders help? What kinds of new initiatives are needed to sort of facilitate this process? Is that the challenge is that it works quite differently from the way that we've been thinking about the way Jewish life is organized in the past. That we've learned and we've conditioned ourselves to thinking about Jewish life as operating through organizations. And I think at least for a substantial period in the next decades, the transition to the third era is going to take place primarily in families, in homes, in small groups. And I think it could be very much fueled by the activities of artists. But those are not organizations. And somehow we're going to have to really think in a creative way about how those folks out there who have resources to spare, whether they're financial or otherwise, and want to help this process move forward, how are they going to invest that resource if It's not through organizations. I think that's a real conundrum that grows out of the perspective that we're taking and out of the learnings that we've been doing over the last couple of years, and that I don't have an easy answer for, but I think it's one of the big questions that ought to be talked about in all the different realms, whether those are foundations or federations or just among people with talent to contribute. How are we going to reimagine the way that we help the system function well?
Yeah, I want to revisit something that that came up in what you're saying, but that sort of harkens back to what we're talking about, is the barriers to making this happen. Because I realize we said that it's just permission and mental blocks, and I there is a large part of me that still thinks that's the primary piece. But I wanted to just name, I think it'd be bad to ignore that we still have as barriers things like racism in Jewish communities towards Jews of color, towards not Jews of color. We have all sorts of class structures that make it very, very hard for people who don't have financial resources to be at the forefront of the work that we hope would happen. We have sexism, we have homophobia, we have all of these things that play out, not just in Jewish life, but in society writ large, that we need to wrestle with in our Jewish spaces. And I don't want to underestimate that, because what we've heard over and over again, whether it's from Juan Mejia or from April Baskin or from Sandra Lawson or Josh Lesser, we've heard from people that say the very thing that fuels their creative Judaism is the fact that they come from a background that is perceived, whether actually or not, to be not normative. And they bring that, and they bring something that has not been introduced in most Jewish spaces, whether that's just their literal body hasn't been seen in Jewish spaces, or their ideas. And if we don't find a way to overcome everything from Ashkenormativity, the centralization of Ashkenazi East European Jews in Jewish life, to classism, to all of this stuff, then that's going to continue to be more than a stumbling block. It's going to be tragic for what our Jewish population can achieve. And perhaps more importantly, it's just going to be terrible morally. Like, we can't keep doing that independent of whether it's the best thing for the Jewish future, which, by the way, I do think it would be.
Right. I mean, so first of all, I want to, full agreement, it would be immoral and therefore we shouldn't do it, period. And what you're raising is a critically important point, which is fundamentally, one way to say it is who's at the table. But, it's interesting because the natural response to I've been excluded from the table is to demand a seat at the table. And that's where I say, there's a moral obligation to give everybody a seat at the table and to give and there is absolutely a right to get a seat at the table. And some of the most powerful work from those folks who are denied a seat at the table is when they create their own table. And then and then they tend to be very inviting towards others to come to their table. And actually, I was just talking to somebody today from an LGBT synagogue who, gave me the metaphor that was just so striking and so beautiful to me, is that in Psalms 118, that the stone that the builders threw away shall become the foundation stone. And in that sense, right, that was used when this person was talking to me about it, as the idea, right, that the LGBT community was cast away and built their own synagogues that have become these, very inviting places to many others, and that have in many ways become central to the experiences of many Jews today. And so on the one hand, of course, and we've talked about this, on the one hand, of course, we want to have audacious hospitality and for everybody to be included and to have a seat at the table. And we want to encourage people who, not only those who are excluded due to terrible, immoral things like racism and sexism and homophobia and all the other isms, but also people that are excluded for all kinds of other reasons that are just like, they don't like this the way it is or whatever, you know, and one option is to come and change it. And I absolutely believe that all of those folks should be invited to have voice. But the other option is to essentially exit, as we talked about early on, the idea versus exit or voice as a way to express dissent, and to say, I'm voting by exit, but I'm not exiting Judaism. I'm exiting this Jewish institution, and I actually have a vision for something profoundly different. And I guess what I'm saying is that I'm encouraging those folks to say, you know, this is an era where we need those stones that have been cast away to actually become the foundation stone. And to become the foundation stone means to build a new structure.
I love that foundation stone idea. I think this whole idea that which is cast away can then turn into the future seems like an appropriate metaphor for what we're trying to do in a lot of ways. So with that, we're going to wrap this up. There's, you know, many, many more hours that we could talk about and will talk about in the future, but hopefully this has been a good chance to look back, if you've been a listener since the get-go, on some of the overarching themes that we've looked at. And if you're newer to for the first time, hear some of the ideas that we've been schmoozing about for the last couple of years. So I hope that you have gotten something out of this, and we want to close out this episode just as we have every single time before and will in the future with just a few ways for you to be in touch with us. First, you can hit us up on Facebook. Just our page is Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. Like Dan said, there's all sorts of good stuff on there. We've been growing the amount of resources over the past couple of years, and we hope to continue in the future. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we like to make, and which Dan made at the beginning of the episode, is that you can always support us financially, either on a one-time basis or a monthly recurring gift, and you can do either of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.